discussing the right, the Mishnah. This is all going on the one line of the Mishnah, many, many blocks on that one line of the Mishnah, that says that if a person denies the idea of Tchiyas HaMeisim, or even if he admits Tchiyas HaMeisim, but he says it is not found in the Torah, he does not have a share in Olam Haba. Okay, very, very severe. So as a result, we get into a discussion, various discussions of Tchiyas HaMeisim. And here, these are different drushas that interpret different psukim that would otherwise be difficult to understand, and that is Amar Rav Tavi, Amar Rav Yashia. My dichsiv, this is a pasuk at the very end of Mishlei that describes Sha'il. Sha'il is a term for a grave, right? Remember, Yaakov always says, if you don't bring back Binyamin, I will go in pain to the Sha'ol, to the netherworld, to the grave. So it mentions Sha'ol, the Otzer Rechem. Otzer Rechem means a woman with a closed womb. In other words, basically it's comparing some very difficult things. So it says Sha'ol, death is difficult, and the withholding of life when a woman is infertile. And the third thing is Eretz Le'Sava Mayim, when the earth is not satisfied with water, it does not get enough water. Right? But the Gemara asks the question, what is the comparison between Sha'ol, which is a grave, and a womb? They're two different things. A grave is where a dead body is buried, and a womb is where a live birth comes out. Ma inyan Sha'ol etzel rechem. Why does it compare Sha'ol, a grave, and a rechem, a womb? So the answer is, this is an indirect reference to Tchiyas HaMeisim. Lomar lecha, ma rechem, a womb, machnas, you put something in it, the zera, right? The sperm goes into the womb, umotzi, and something comes out of it, namely a baby. Af sha'il, the grave is exactly the same thing, machnas, you put something in it, umotzi, and something will come out of it. In other words, that's why the grave is a womb, because the grave, in a sense, is an incubator for the future life of Tchiyas HaMeisim. And therefore, that's a remez to Tchiyas HaMeisim. Now, of course, this is not in the Torah. This is a verse in Mishlei, Book of Proverbs. And then Rav Yeshia goes on and says, Halo devarim kal v'chomer. And I'll make a kal v'chomer that if a womb can produce life, how much more so a grave can produce life. What's the kal v'chomer? Ma rechem machnisim bo b'chashoy. A rechem is a womb, what you deposit in the rechem is done very, very quietly and privately, right? Marital intercourse is done privately. And yet, motzien mimenu, the life that comes out, is bekole kolos, quite loud, right? Crying, and again, it's, you can learn it two different ways. The kole kolos might be the noise that the baby makes, or it might be the great excitement that people have when a baby is born, right? Everybody's excited. So, Sha'il, the grave, machnisim bo v'kolos, right? We bury a dead body. There's a lot of, not excitement, but a lot of voices. People are crying, people are eulogizing. So if even that which is done quietly produces a tremendous tumult upon birth, so that which is done with a lot of tumult, it will certainly produce life that will be a big, big simcha, as it were. Ein odin shemotzien mimenu v'kol kolos, and mikan teshuva, and this is a refutation, the omrim, to those people who say, those skeptics who say, ein tchiyas HaMeisim min haTorah, that there's no proof to tchiyas HaMeisim min haTorah. Now, of course, this is a little difficult. It's not really clear how this is a response to them. It might be a response to those who deny Tchiyas HaMeisim, but it's certainly not a response to those who say, I believe in Tchiyas HaMeisim, but I believe it's not found in the Torah. Well, you're not proving that that's wrong, because you're giving a drasha from a pasuk in Mishlei. So you see from this that sometimes when Chazal use the word Torah, they are not limiting themselves to the five books of Moses, but they include in the concept of Torah all of the Kitzvei HaKodesh, all of the sacred writings, which includes Nevi'im and Ksuvim, and therefore Mishlei would be considered to be part of Torah based on that definition. Interestingly enough, this comparison, that the same way in the Rechem you put something in and you get something out. So in the kever, you put something in, you get something out. And it makes the point that when a child is born, it's b'kolei kolos. This is actually a very beautiful medrash. The medrash in Kohelet says like this. The medrash in Kohelet says that we make a big, big simcha when a child is born. And we have a lot of sadness, a lot of grieving when somebody dies. But the medrash says maybe the opposite ought to be the case. The medrash gives the following mashal. Let's say I have a ship. I'm a trader. And I have a ship that's going to China, going to India. This is in the ancient times when that was a very, very hazardous voyage. So it's the derech that when a ship begins a big journey, we also make a very big simcha. You know, they break champagne on the ship and everything else. And then when the ship comes back and it's laden with all of its treasures, people don't even notice. It just, you know, docks and it unloads. But he says the opposite ought to be the case, because when the ship embarks on its journey, who knows whether it's going to be successful? Maybe it will sink. Maybe it will have pirates. There are still pirates even today. You know, Somalia, you pirates, you know. I think pirates are like from the 1700s or something. I know, people are hijacking ships. But when a ship comes back and it's done its mission, that ought to be a simcha. So the Midrash says life and death is very much the same way. When a baby is born, it's like the neshama is setting off on a long, long journey till it comes home to Hashem. Right? Dying is coming home to Hashem. So when the child is born, we ought to be a little fearful. Who says the child will be a good person? Who says the child will live up to its potential? And when a person dies, and Yemir Sashem, if a person lives a good life and a virtuous life, there ought to be that symptom. In other words, the same way we mistakenly celebrate when the ship leaves, and we don't celebrate when the ship comes back, the Midrash says, so too, we celebrate the birth, which is the beginning of the trip, and we don't celebrate the death, which is the end of the trip. And the Midrash actually says that sometimes the simcha ought to be the opposite way, way around. In fact, somebody asked me a shayla the other day, Yishalmi Tzaddik died. He's not like an old-time Tzaddik who goes back many generations, but he was somebody who came 30 years ago and became very well-known as Tzaddik. And in fact, his Levaya was like 3 o'clock in the morning, because as you know, in the Yerushalayim, especially in the Old City, we don't allow a mace to be overnight. So even if somebody dies, were you at Levaya? Oh. Even if somebody dies, you know, 4 in the morning, they'll bury him by 4:30 in the morning. You don't wait until the crack of dawn. So somebody was discussing this with me. He actually left Beit Sava. Now, halachically, it's very problematical, but he left Beit Sava that he didn't want his house of Avelis, his Shiva house, to be a house of sadness. He wanted people to sing and dance in the Shiva house. Halachically, it's a real problem. Even at the funeral, they told me, I wasn't there, I didn't know the person. At the funeral, they were singing and dancing. I mean, a lot of his people were like Karlbach people. I mean, they weren't, you know, established B'nai Torah, and the Chevra Kedisha let them sing and dance as long as they were doing the slow Karlbach songs. But then they started into Siman Tov and Mazel Tov, whatever it is. So the Chevra Kedisha stepped in and said, can't do that at Levaya, you know, can't do Siman Tov and Mazel Tov. So, you know, okay, what do you do? But there is a certain concept that the death of a tzaddik, although it's a tremendous loss for us, is actually a great simcha for the tzaddik, because the tzaddik is now returning from his voyage and is back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because life is a very dangerous voyage. We don't realize this is kind of the analogy. The neshama is constantly afraid that it might do things wrong, it might make mistakes, it might do aveiros. Every single minute is a nisayan. We live in a world of nisayan. I don't want to get people depressed, but we live in a world like you're going through a minefield. Now you have to be besimcha, even so, you have to serve Hashem with simcha. But you're going through a minefield. And one can imagine from the perspective of the tzaddik who has successfully navigated the minefield. How do you feel when you're out of the minefield? You have a tremendous sense of relief and repose. And that's how the tzaddik is when the tzaddik's neshama goes to Olam Haba. So he actually said, I mean, not that he said he was, he didn't say he was a tzaddik, although he was a tzaddik, but he actually said he wanted his Shiva has to be a place of simcha. And in truth, I mean, I myself recently sat Shiva. I mean, in truth, you will notice this. A Shiva house is sad, but there is often a certain element of simcha in a Shiva house. It's hard to explain. It's not the simcha of dancing around and singing, but it's a simcha that somebody lived a good life. They were a good person. They were a righteous person. And you get a certain enjoyment by reviewing the good they did in their life and how it impacted on you and the like. So you'll often find when you walk into a Shiva, now again, every Shiva is different. I mean, if God forbid a young child died, you know, I mean, every Shiva is a different dynamic. But if somebody like lived a long life and lived a good life, you walk into a Shiva house, you're not going to necessarily see, you know, everybody is somber and serious and weeping and crying. There'll be a certain sense of, it is a bit of a celebration in a sense. So the notion of the simcha, the Medrash is Meramis to, is not, and this tzaddik was talking about, is not so foreign, actually. There actually is certain elements of the simcha of a person who's gone through the minefields of life and did an okay situation.
Are there any Gemaric descriptions of the Leviathan?
Yes, there are. I will tell you this, it's interesting. There are a lot of things that we would absolutely not do today that were done at Leviathan in the time of the Gemara. The Gemara discusses, number one, that they had musical instruments at Leviathan. They had flutes. And the flutes were designed to bring out emotions and the like, and they would actually play music as Leviathan, which we certainly absolutely do not do today. And what is even more surprising, there were choirs of women, that would sing together, because once again, in a wailing way, and that would kind of arouse the crowd to tears. Now today, we tell you, we certainly don't allow it because of Kol Isha, the singing of women. However, at the time of the Gemara, the implication was that at least at a Levaya, people were not frivolous, and therefore they did not come to improper sexual stimulation. So, and we also have in Maseches Moed Katan some of the eulogies that the sages gave on each other. Very, very brief eulogies, maybe one or two lines. Mm-hmm. But there were poems that were recited. There tend to be rhymes. In other words, there was a profession. Today, who gives a eulogy? It's either a rabbi, a friend, family member. But in the time of Chazal, there used to be people, their profession. They were professional eulogizers. They would compose like poetic compositions. That would eulogize the meaning of life, the meaning of death. So instead of what we're talking about, we have a number of examples of those things. That is why on Tisha B'Av, you're not allowed to learn a regular Torah. You're only allowed to learn the sad things about mourning or about Tisha B'Av. So the two most popular things people study in Gemara are either the seventh parak of Gittin, which is the destruction of the temple. That's the famous story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. That's a famous Agabata on the Churban Beis HaMikdash, or they study Maseches, the third parak of Moed Katan, which are all the laws of mourning. That's more a bit more technical, but there is Agadita there as well about the eulogies and the funeral customs and the legend. Yeah. So the idea of Simcha at the time of death, as I say, the Medrash itself alludes to that as having a certain legitimacy. Okay. Now, we have yet another brayse. Again, we go on and on with many details of Tchiyas HaMeisim, although not all the details. And this Tanit Ve'Eliyahu. Now, this is an interesting expression. Tana, it was taught in the house meaning the Beis HaMedrash, of Eliyahu. You know the expression, Tana Ve'Eliyahu. In fact, at the end of davening every day, when they say Ein Kelokeinu. Right, so we quote something, Tana Dve Eliyahu, it was taught in the house of Eliyahu, right, the famous mimer, Halashayna Halachos B'chol Yom, anybody who learns Halachos every day is guaranteed that he will have a share in Olam Haba. So I'm not talking about the mimer, but I just want to explicate for a moment, what is Tana Dve Eliyahu? So actually it's brought down in Mefarshim that this was a Beis Medrash of Eliyahu HaNavi, Eliyahu the prophet, who never died. And even to this very day, he sometimes reveals himself to great tzaddikim. That one of the signs that a person has Ruach HaKodesh, although you wouldn't know it, he's not going to tell you necessarily, is that Eliyahu HaNavi appears to him. And I can't tell you firsthand. I mean, he doesn't appear to me, I'll tell you, so that much I can say, but I can't tell you who he appears to. But we do know that certainly we do have documented proof that in recent years there were Gedolim that had Gili Eliyahu, whether it was the Chafetz Chaim, the Stipler, people like that. Again, I'm sure there are people even today, if you consider Chaim Kineski, I don't know firsthand. But because of this, Eliyahu HaNavi used to appear with some frequency to the great Tanan and Amoraim, and they actually had a sporadic base medrash. It wasn't an everyday base medrash, but he would come and assemble them and teach them Torah, and that is what the Gemara means when it says Tana, it was taught in the base medrash of Eliyahu. In fact, there is a medrash, one of the midrashim, is a collection of these teachings, and it is called, it's a beautiful medrash, it is called Tana Devei Eliyahu. Have you ever you've seen it, or you've heard of it? So the Gemara will have sporadic teachings called Tana Devei Eliyahu, but there's a big medrash, Tana Devei Eliyahu. In fact, the Gemara is going to quote one of those teachings right now, but I'll just mention one very, very phenomenal teaching of Tana Devei Eliyahu that is quoted there. Eliyahu HaNavi asked Hashem, or he quoted Hashem, Hashem said to Eliyahu HaNavi, there are two things that I love with a complete, undiminished love. The Torah and the Jewish people. These are the two things that I love more than anything. Eliyahu HaNavi asked Hashem, who do you love more? Hashem didn't want to answer. Eliyahu HaNavi pushed him. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu answered the Jewish people. As great as Hashem's love for the Torah is, Hashem's love for the Jewish people is even greater. That's in Tana Devei Eliyahu.
You mean Eliyahu HaNavi gathered the Jewish people in the Beit Medrash? Is that what you mean? What do you mean by that?
No, what I just said now?
Not before. Like,
not the whole Jewish people, but he would appear to some selected group of...
In the Beit Medrash.
They would have a base medrash, they would go to a room, he would just gather them to a certain place, and he would teach them.
Okay, so these are the teachings.
Yeah, so these are the teachings, so this is what it means. Lamashal, when we say Tana Devei Rabbi Yishmael, that just means it was taught in Rabbi Yishmael's base medrash, but these are Tanam and Amoraim.
Right.
The Chiddush is Eliyahu HaNavi himself had a base medrash where he would sometimes come and teach people. Now I don't think it was reserved just for him. I think it was just he took over. Right? Let's say you'd be coming from Marav that night. It might say closed, open only to people who see Eliyahu HaNavi tonight. Okay, yeah. I don't know exactly how they did it, but that actually was it. Yeah.
While we're on the topic, just two questions. So are there actual records of the recent appearances of Eliyahu HaNavi to the staff records of that?
No, we don't have records. Now, even then, I maybe call it documented evidence. I can't say that we have documented evidence, but people were made either the Gadol mentioned it for various reasons. Now, I do know this. We don't know what this was exactly. There was a great, great tzaddik that many people don't hear of today, but he was so great. He was like the Chafetz Chaim's mentor. He was like the Chafetz Chaim's spiritual rebbe. He was like the Chafetz Chaim before the Chafetz Chaim. And this was a person called Rav Nachum Kaplan. He's called Rav Nachum Kaplan. He was called very affectionately. Rav Nachum Kaplan lived in Haradna. And Chafetz Chaim used to keep Rav Nachum's picture on his person to have the face of a real tzaddik. And Rav Nachum, unusual person, Rav Nachum had a very, very hard life. He was a big, big Talmud Chacham. But he only wanted to be the shamus of his shul. He was to clean up and take out the garbage. But he refused anything more than a shamash. He says that is enough for him, that's an honor for him. And he spent his days teaching people, gave classes and doing chesed and doing tzedakah. And he was a great, great, like hidden tzaddik. Although eventually he was relatively well known. So they say when Chafetz Chaim was like 13, he had latched onto the fact that Rav Nachumke was a great hidden tzaddik. and he wanted to follow him around surreptitiously. And Rav Nachum Kahneminak, that after Myra, again, the shul that he was in, I guess, didn't have people learning late at night. So after Myra, you know, some shuls are that way, right? After Myra, you know, people leave, they lock up the shul. So after Myra, he would lock up the shul. Chabad Chaim noticed that Rav Nachum stayed in the shul for several hours after Myra. So the Chabad Chaim wanted to know what Rav Nachum was doing exactly. So he hid under the benches after Myra, and everybody leaves. And Nachum sits down, learning, and so far no big surprise. And all of a sudden, the room fills with fire. And Chabad Chaim thought, he's a child, he thought that the candles fell down and it was maybe there was a fire in the shop. So he screams, he gives himself away, he says, "There's a fire!" And Rav Nachum didn't even get up. Basically what was going on, this was the Gilui of Eliyahu HaNavi or whatever. The room totally filled with light. But they say on this Maisa that if you're not a person worthy of the revelation of Eliyahu HaNavi, you're not going to see the light. But say the fact that if any of us would have been in the room, we wouldn't have seen anything. The fact that Chabad Chaim saw the light meant he was also spiritually worthy of that revelation of Eliyahu HaNavi. So this is what the light is recording.
Why is it that Eliyahu HaNavi is so special? Why is it not Moshe Rabbeinu? Why is it not something else?
Well, the reason is the idea is following. Eliyahu HaNavi is unique because he is the one person who entered Gan Eden in a physical body. And the Shema did not separate from the Guf. So as a result, only Eliyahu HaNavi can come back to Earth as a physical being. Because even Moshe Rabbeinu, the Neshama separated. Now, why, it doesn't answer your question totally. In other words, that is why Eliyahu is different than anybody else. But the question is, why was he given that? Why was he given that distinction? It seems to be connected to the fact that according to Chazal, Eliyahu HaNavi was actually Pinchas, the Kohen. And because Pinchas stood up and was zealous for the honor of Hashem, he was given the covenant of peace to be able to bring peace between Am Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, part of his bracha of peace, that is, he can always come down and effect reconciliation. It's connected to Eliyahu being Pinchas. Now, what was it? There are many, many ma'asim that he would go from house to house as a beggar often, and different stories in the Midrashim about it. Okay. So anyway, so now this is a little bit of an introduction, but this is simply introducing a teaching. It was taught in the Beis Medrash of Eliyahu, which is Eliyahu HaNavi. Sadikim she'asir HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'hachayosam. The righteous people that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to bring back from the dead, einam chayzrim li'afaram, they will never return to their death, meaning he's making the point that Techiyas HaMeisim is eternal. It's not that the dead get resurrected and then they die again, but Techiyas HaMeisim is an eternal process. Now, it is interesting that the Rambam, apparently, it's not clear what his source is, the Rambam does not paskin like this, Mimra, because the Rambam indeed paskins, right? The Rambam actually has a shita that the only thing that is eternal is the soul surviving in Olam Haba. That is eternal. But the return of the soul to the physical body via Techiyas HaMeisim is a one-time thing that happens, and then people are going to die again. So it's a little strange. Everybody gets revived at the same time, and then people die. And now, we don't even know what that means. Do they die at the same time? Do they die in a lifespan? Whatever it is. But according to the Rambam, the Nitzchius, the eternity of rewards, is only Olam Haba. But most shitas, the Derech Hashem, and most Kabbalistic, all Kabbalistic views, actually follow this view. If it's coming from Eliyahu HaNavi, he's in a good position to know. It's interesting. How do you dispute Eliyahu HaNavi on this? That he says that they will not return to the dead, that Techiyas HaMeisim is going to be eternal. And he quotes a verse in Yeshayo the Navi that says, V'hoya ha'nishar b'tzion, those who will remain in Zion, Haneser v'Yushalayim, those who will remain in Jerusalem, meaning who will come back from the dead. Kadosh Yeyomer Lo, they shall be proclaimed to be holy. Kol HaKasuv L'Chayim v'Yushalayim, all of those who are inscribed for life. So it mentions that those who are inscribed for life, which is a reference to Tchias HaNesen, are described as Kadosh. Now, it doesn't say they'll live forever directly, but it does call them Kadosh. So based on this, we say the following. We are comparing the resurrected dead to things that you proclaim as holy, right? A person could make anything hektish. I can make a table hektish. I can make an animal hektish. Now, what is the characteristic of hektish? Ma li'olam kayam. Ma kadosh li'olam kayam. When you make something hektish, it is holy forever. Once something is hektish, the kedusha never goes off. Af hein, so too the resurrected dead, the olam kayom, right, will live forever. But then the Braisa goes on and says, v'yim tomar, but if you're going to ask me, o son shanim, she'asid HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'chadesh b'hem es olamo, she'nemar, V'niskav Hashem levadai b'yomahu. There is a teaching, again, this is alluding to a teaching that we really didn't have yet, and that's going to be explained later on. But there is a concept that the world will exist for 6,000 years, and then there'll be 1,000 years of Mashiach, and then the world gets destroyed for 1,000 years, and then it gets recreated. That there's kind of 1,000 years of destruction. And that's the meaning of the pasuk, v'niskav Hashem levadai. Hashem will be alone by Yom Ahu on that day meaning that millennium. So the question is, how do you reconcile the idea that once there's resurrection of the dead, they live forever, with the idea that there is a period where everything is destroyed and then recreated? Right, how do you reconcile that? So it answers this way. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Eislam Kinafayim Kinesharim, meaning the world gets destroyed, but the resurrected bodies are given wings like angels, and they fly above the waters. Now obviously this means much more than would appear superficially, but essentially it means that the notion that Hashem destroys the world does not mean that everything is obliterated, meaning the earth is destroyed, so to speak, but all of those people who have been revived, they kind of get preserved in some heavenly realm, and then they're brought back into the earth when there's a recreation. Hashem etaymar, and maybe you'll say, well, that process of moving from earth to heaven, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, causes them pain. That, you know, part of the resurrection would be painful as I go back and forth? The answer is no. Talmud Lomar, that is why the Pasuk tells us, Vekovei Hashem, those who hope in Hashem, Yachlifu Koach, will be given renewed strength and energy. Yalu Eiver Kanisharim, they will have wings like the eagles. So it's referring specifically to this process. Yarutsu, they will run. Lo ye go, they will not be exhausted. Yelchu, they will walk. Lo ye offu, and they will not be tired. Right, that's the idea that when you serve Hashem properly, Hashem gives you more energy. This even applies to us in our Madrega. Hashem gives you more koach. So the Tanav Eliyahu therefore makes the position, its bottom line is that once there's resurrection, the body never returns to the dust. That even when Hashem destroys the world, the bodies and the soul fly up, and they're still going to be preserved in some way.
Aren't there like machlekes about what the 1,000 years entails?
Yes. The truth of the matter is that this is a brisa that is alluding to something without really explaining it, and it's going to be explained later on.
Oh, okay. This is where the premise comes from.
But again, this is only an allusion. So there'll be a further discussion of those 1,000 years of destruction. But now the Gemara asks Akasha, that if you remember, there is one instance of a mass Techiyas HaMesim in the Nevi'im themselves, and this is the story of Yechezkel. Yechezkel was a Navi, and he was a Navi who lived in Babel, not Eretz Israel. And if you remember, the Babylonian exile actually took place in two different stages. Initially, Babylonia conquered Eretz Israel, and it exiled the important aristocracy, and including Talmidei Chachamim, to Babel. And that was 11 years before the Churban. And it left the poor people in the land with the Beis HaMikdash. 11 years later was the actual destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So it's two stages. Mordechai, for example, was exiled in the first wave. That's why it says he was exiled in Yechaniah Melchidu, which is the first wave of the exiles. So just to give you an example of the Nevi'im, Yechezkel was a Navi who was exiled to Babylonia in the first wave of exiles. Yirmiyahu stayed in Eretz Yisrael and actually experienced the Churban. But so both, they're mamish contemporaries, Yechezkel and Yirmiyahu, unlike Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu was before the exile of the 10 tribes. He was more than 100 years before this. But Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel are the Nevi'im who actually experienced the Churban. Yirmiyahu experienced it directly here, and Yechezkel experienced it in Babel is Iraq. And one of the points, so as a result, both Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel, as well as Yeshayahu before that, get many prophecies of comfort, not just destruction. And one of the prophecies is that Yechezkel was taken to a valley, and the valley just had thousands and thousands of dried bones that were just drying out in the bottom, even human bones. And Hashem told him to prophesy over those bones. And the bones began to join together. There began to be flesh on the bones. And there was a resurrection of the dead. These were Jewish people. We'll discuss actually who they were. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Yirmiyahu, these bones are symbolic of the Jewish people. People think they're dried bones, their hope is lost, they'll never be a geula. But just as these dead bones will become alive, so too the Jewish people will once again be alive and joyous in their land. However, we do have a tradition that those mason died soon afterwards. They became alive and then they died. So the Gemara asks, how can you say once there's Tchias HaMesim, nobody dies, those people don't die? What about the mason that Yechezkel saw? They did die. So the Gemara's answer is, according to Tana Develio, Savar La Kamandi Amar B'yemes Mashal Haya. That there actually is an opinion, we're going to see in a moment, there actually is an opinion that the story of the Mason was a prophetic dream that Yechezkel had. It did not actually happen. Meaning, there's going to be a machlokas. Did he actually do this? Now, of course, it's from Hashem. We're not questioning it's from God, but the question is, did God make him do an actual experience, or did God give him a dream? So if it was a dream, then obviously it's not relevant to the issue of whether those who are revived survive or not. And the Gemara talk is...
Isn't the prophecy used through, like, a dream or, like, an experience? Like, when he said he prophesied, it would make sense that it was...
Well, on the other hand, you know, it's true that when the prophecy is Hashem tells me things, so usually that'll be through dreams. But the question is, this is really the question, when you have a prophecy that involves doing something, speak over these bones and bring them to life, do you understand that as something he actually did, or is that part of the dream? In other words, what is part of the dream, right, so to speak? So according to one view, he actually did this, but the Tana Gemara takes the position that this was a mashal, this was a parable, and it was a dream, and it did not actually happen. And the Gemara discusses a few opinions. Rabbi Eliezer is the first view, who says that Yechezkel revived these dead people, they stood on their feet, they praised Hashem, and then they died right afterwards. That is one view. And Rabbi Yehuda's view is that the whole thing was a parable and it did not really, really happen. Now let me just mention the third view. There's a third view that says those Mason went back to Eretz Yisrael, they got married, and they had children. They didn't just, others, they did die, but they actually were able to go to Eretz Yisrael, have children, and Rav Yehuda ben Basera gets up and says, I am descended from them, and these are the tefillin I got from my great-great grandfather. Now, who were they? We'll talk about this tomorrow. We'll talk about it Wednesday. But according to one view, these were the Bnei Ephraim. Now, again, we have to go back a little bit. If you remember, there was a large group of people from the tribe of Ephraim who left Egypt on their own 30 years before Moshe Rabbeinu, mm-hmm. because they believed they were capable of being redeemed, and they did get massacred because it wasn't the time to leave yet. There was no Moshe Rabbeinu there yet. And according to this tradition, they are the mason that Yechezkel brought back to life.
The thing is, where geographically are the bones? Because if they left Egypt, why would they near be bubble?
No, so according to this, they weren't in Babel. According to this, Hashem miraculously transported Yechezkel to wherever these bones were buried, or on the ground, and the like. But these were the Bnei Ephraim. Now, just a little thought. Why did Bnei Ephraim think 30, I mean, why did they leave exactly when they left? Because here is the thing. You have to know that Hashem told Abraham that your children will be enslaved in a land that is not theirs for 400 years. Now, that was said when Abraham was 70 years old. And the 400 years don't begin running till the birth of Yitzchak, mm-hmm. which is when Abraham was 100 years old. So really, from the covenant until Yetzias Mitzrayim is 430 years. And indeed, the Chumash itself says that from the covenant to the redemption was 430. We were only 210 in Egypt, but from the covenant to the redemption was 430. But the Bnei Ephraim thought that you start counting the 400 years not from the birth of Yitzchak, you start counting the 400 years from the covenant. And therefore they thought that the time had arrived 30 years beforehand.
Or would have been, if anything, Genting is amazing, because they weren't at Sinai, so they never became officially
well,
Jewish.
Well, that's the interesting question. On one hand, that's correct. They were not at Matan Torah. That's correct. They died before the Exodus. They didn't have a Korban Pesach. Right? There are a whole bunch of things they did not do. But because they are the descendants of Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, they are still considered to be Jewish.
Does that mean that the four-fifths of Jews that died in Egypt, would they also be resurrected?
That's a good question. We'll talk about that a little bit, but I would just say the following, that there is a difference, because the four-fifths who died in Egypt, they were rejecting the idea of Hashem's redemption. The Bnei Ephraim were accepting it, but they miscalculated. Well, there's a very big difference between one who believes in Hashem's promise of redemption, even if you miscalculate, versus someone who rejects it. See, the four-fifths didn't want to leave Egypt.
So they found the category of the ones who lose their lama, I guess?
Yeah. So that's a different situation than the people who wanted Hashem's redemption, but they left the wrong time. So I think there could be a very strong difference between them.
I heard there also might be, like, there was, like, a false Mashiach for the tribe of Ephraim,
that's true. They must have had some leader. We don't know his name. But again, the basis of it was the interpretation of the biblical 400 years. Okay? So we have three different views about the story about Yechezkel. One view says the whole thing was a parable, a dream. Another says they said Shira to Hashem and they immediately died. And the third view is they actually were given the zechus of coming to Eretz Yisrael, even marrying and having children. And then they died, but their descendants continued within the Jewish people. Right? So there, some of us might be descendants, according to Yehuda ben Basera, of these people, the Mason Shehechia.
Was it the whole tribe that went?
No. Obviously, it wasn't the whole tribe, because in the census in the Chumash, we have people from the Bnei Ephraim.
Oh.
I mean, Yeshua ben Nun is from Ephraim, right?
So,
so it's not the whole tribe, but there were families in the tribe that decided to go along. Like anything else, you know, we have had the problem of false Mashiach many, many years afterwards, it's a problem that Pauli saw things. Okay, see you later.
Obviously, I mean, they were miming in a shem, even though they were on the 49th level of Tumah in Mitzrayim. There was always like a small group of faithful people.
Yes, they were miming in Hashem, and they went to Shem Shemayim. Again, some people want to compare it to even to Zionism in the sense that you try to build a state, but it's not the right time or it's too early. You know, it's not a good thing to do.
And then I guess we're all in trouble.
Yeah. Well, then the Turek Harkis says that I'd like to have a state until the coming of Mashiach. Right? That's their position.
It's kind of having a state if like a part of the people don't like believe in the state. They're just like, it just happens to be a government.
No, so those people don't believe. And the Jakarta doesn't believe in the state, so they don't. So that's what they say. They say there's no legitimate state here. Mm. But I think most of us believe we have disagreements with the state, but most of us believe it is a state. I mean. Religious parties, have members in the Knesset.
Right.
You know, they hold government positions. So most of us do accept the legitimacy of the state, even if one has disagreements with it. But the Turei Karja does not accept the legitimacy of the state, meaning they will not accept money from the state, etc. They will not, Some of them, it depends. Even within the Turei Karja, you have ultra from the Turei Karja. Will not allow the city to collect garbage. He will take the position that I'll do it on my own or whatever. But some say they will allow city services. They will not allow. They will not accept national services. It's a city, municipality. That you can have a government for, but not a national government. You know? But I'll tell you, Hashem has a cosmic sense of humor. I'll tell you this: the head of the Turei Karja, the founder, was a great, great tzaddik, Rav Amram Blau. Very, very, he was a very clutch of a person. And he was very, very zealous. He would not accept anything from the government at all. So he happened, people gave him, because he was a Baal Tzedakah, people would give him money and property that he would then liquidate and distribute to different people. So he was given lands around Givat Ram. It's in Yerushalayim. He was given land. I'm leaving out the punchline for the end. And the idea was he was to liquidate the land and get money. The government desperately wanted that land, and through something called eminent domain, just like in America, they can condemn the property and pay it. So he could have gotten like $1 million, whatever it would be, a lot of money, which he would give to Tzedakah. But because he considered the government thieves, he said, you don't negotiate with a thief. He says he refused to take money from the government. So the government just took the land without paying for it. And on that land is constructed the Knesset. So the Knesset, is built on property that is owned by the Turei Karja.
That's a
go figure.